Hi, Jack. Welcome to the WeChat Tech Podcast. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm very well. I'm very well.
Good,
Thanks
good,
for
good.
coming on board and being one of our guests. For all the
Nice.
listeners out there, it'd be good to understand a little bit more about yourself first. So if you could give a short intro on Jack.
So I'm Jack Beecham-Sansfield. I am currently the DevOps manager at Formula One. Started there as a DevOps engineer a few years ago and have slowly grown as the team has expanded and we've taken on more responsibility. So, I'm very excited to be here. So,
Nice. Good stuff. Good stuff. Look, first, let's dive into more of your career journey, I guess, and sort of explore what sort of got you into tech, firstly, like what sort of pulled you into it, I guess.
So for me, my journey's a bit of an odd one, to be honest. So at school I was always into science and all that kind of stuff. And my school, while an amazing school, didn't really do computing. It was very old fashioned. It was all about, classics and history and all the real subjects, none of these newfangled computers and stuff. So they had amazing computing facilities, but they didn't really do anything with them, other than teach you how to use PowerPoint and stuff. So I went started off doing science. So I went to university to study chemistry, and while I was there, realized it wasn't for me. So I came back to London and was sort of thinking, what on earth do I do with myself now? I've gone off on that journey. It's not gone quite to plan. How do I progress? Like, what's the next steps? And I spent a lot of time trying different things. But ultimately, I kept falling back on computing because I was a nerd. So I spent my spare time as a teenager playing video games and building PCs and all that kind of stuff. So when I sort of fell out the other side of university without a degree, I was like, well, what can I actually do that's useful? And computers were the sort of my go-to thing. So I started looking for jobs in computing, and I got a initially got a part-time service desk role for a marketing agency, and then sort of that grew into a full-time role, and everything kind of snowballed from there, and slowly but surely started to take responsibility for things like our web hosting and stuff like that. And then had a bit of a fork in the road after that job. My son had just been born and I was looking for something new. Needed a bit, needed a bit of a change, a bit more money, all those kind of usual existential crises you have when you have a child. And I was going for two, there were two jobs sort of in the pipeline. One was with Monzo, actually, in a service desk sort of role. And they weirdly had a very similar stack to ours, which is quite an unusual stack. So it was kind of, I was like, oh, this would be a really easy transition, really good fit, like technology wise. And then the other one was for a small company out in Essex where I live. But it was very sort of AWS focused, and I sort of,
To believe.
yeah, one was a short term gain that would have been really easy in the short, it would have been a really good, like, good bump in pay, good move short term, but it wasn't really heading in the direction I wanted. So I took the other one, and it was very much a side grade, but it set me on the path that was the path I actually wanted to be on. So, and then from there, I've, worked in numerous, AWS houses, doing all kinds of cloud engineering, DevOps engineering sort of things. So, I sort of came from a wayward nerd via the service desk into a sort of cloud engineering and DevOps kind of role. So.
But what would you say that was like the pivotal moment that sort of shaped your career so far? Would you say that transition to that AWS role, the short term sort of
Yeah, I
growth?
was like, don't get me wrong, there's service desk is amazing for a lot of things, but I think after a while you start to lose patience. And I was starting to get to that point where I was just like, I just want to play with computers and do cool things, and I don't want to deal with, the printer's not working and all those kinds of things. And like I say, no shade to the people doing it, because it's hard work and it's crucial, but I think everyone that's done that job gets to a point where they want to move on to something else. So
yeah. I mean, you moved on to obviously DevOps, and you've been in the space for God, nearly 5 years, right? As sort of in DevOps.
Yeah. Well, my son's 8 in December, so yeah, 7-8 years.
Yeah, yeah. So you've been in the space for a long time. So, I mean, firstly, what does DevOps mean to you, I guess? And how have you seen DevOps evolve over from when you started using it?
That is an almost impossible question. means something completely different in every organization I've worked in. So, the trickiest thing with it is it's such a multidisciplinary kind of field that it can mean basically anything. You know, you can be anywhere from sort of a cloud engineer to, you know, doing infrastructure and all that kind of stuff to almost like a release engineer doing sort of release management for other and like anywhere on that spectrum in between. In my current role, we've got a very multidisciplinary team, which is really good. It sort of lends us to being a bit of a Swiss Army knife team. So, you know, and we're always the team that's not afraid to get stuck in and have a go. If someone's not quite sure how something should be done, you know, we'll just have a crack at it and see if we can get anywhere with it. So, it's a strange role. It really is, because it's equal parts sort of human engineering,
I feel like everyone's got different perceptions of it as well. It's really weird, because we had another podcast yesterday with Matteo as well, and for him it was very much on like the DevOps methodology, like how do you refine processes, how do you sort of make the company more efficient and sort of cost effective, I guess.
Yeah, it's all about facilitating things, making people
jobs easier, right?
Yeah, my mate Ben has a good who I think you know has a good way of putting it is that we're sort of force multipliers. You know, we do work to enable other people to do their work more quickly, more efficiently, safer, with, you know, building in processes, guardrails, like all that good stuff to enable them to move faster. But at the same time, you know, we're getting involved in stuff for the race-focused teams. We're getting stuff in for, we're talking to like the finance department about, you know, we're talking to all kinds of teams across the business, because the IT department sort of sees it almost as a business function on the sort of automation side of things as well. So we're really getting into all kinds of parts of the business. So it's very much not just a, you know, it's not just a computing thing. It's not just a software development thing. It's all, like you say, it's all about efficiencies and process. And
I feel like that's what a lot of people are having. I feel like it was different. I feel like even 4 or 5 years back. I feel like it is more sort of based around the people now. Like you're saying, it's how you sort of collaborate to make it happen, right? Because everyone does say like, look, DevOps is a culture and, you know, all that good stuff. But yeah, everyone does have different perceptions, I guess.
Culture is a huge part of the battle.
There you go. So look, from yourself, I mean, you've been at F1, which is obviously really cool. We'll touch on that a little bit later, but you've been there for a good while. What made you sort of transition into a leadership role, I guess? I mean, what was your sort of thought process behind that? And I mean, is leadership, like, do you enjoy leadership? Because I know obviously you say you're a techie at heart, so
it's a weird if I'm honest, one of the best things about it is having something else to do. As in, I historically get quite bad tech burnout sometimes. Like you're in it all the time. It's always changing, it's always moving, you're always having to keep up with all the late, and sometimes you just start to get a little bit like just frazzled with it. So actually having, you know, the guys to sort of, you know, all that extra process to go through, having to look at budgets, having to look at things, while obviously budgeting is nobody's favorite, it's just something a little bit different. So I'm not just all in on the one thing, because I find that if I am just all in on that, it sometimes, you know, it starts to take its toll a little bit, and you start to just kind of, your brain starts to melt sometimes. Or at least mine does.
No, it's good to obviously to almost have it's almost just an escape, obviously, from the tech that you're saying, because obviously it does.
Obviously, I still love the tech side of things, that is like the part I most enjoy about my job. But you know, also just having a different like overview of things, trying to sort of have a more sort of more strategic oversight of what we're doing as a team, rather than just sort of, you know, focusing on I need to get this feature out, or I need to deploy pipelines for these guys, or, you know, whatever it may be on the day. So
do you still stay like very much hands-on from your part?
Yeah, I'm still finding the balance. So I've only been in a managerial role since April, because that's when we do the renewals for the year. And to start with, everything just hard over to like meetings and management and stuff, because my manager obviously was like, right, well, you know, so there's a within I'm part of the cloud and DevOps like team, and obviously there's a cloud team and a DevOps team. There's a lot of overlap between the two. We do, but we sort of have our sort of specialties within that sort of overlapping middle ground. And so you know, he was overseeing both sides, and then but was obviously with a team of nearly 10 between both sides of the disciplines. It was way too much for just him to be doing, so he stepped back, and well, he stepped up and then split it into two, and that was a much more manageable amount for the both of us, I think. So but he was very obviously excited to just be like, right, all these meetings over to you guys, have fun. And so my calendar for the first couple of months was just wall-to-wall meetings, but I've slowly started to claw some of it back into, you know, doing a bit more technological work. But I'm still trying to find that balance, because, you know, I try and block my calendar, but at the same time
you can't
meeting things to happen.
It's like you said though, it's you're a techie at heart, right? So you want to stay techie as well, I guess.
Yeah,
I think, you know, really, we speak to everyone that's like, you know, managers and directors, and they always say the same thing. Like, they love what they do, and it's the same. What you see from yourself, obviously, you love what you do, but it's, you know, they still want to, you know, do the like get their hands dirty and just
And I think it's really important to keep your eye on the ball, or whatever, you know, keep yourself in that brain space, even just a little bit, even if you're stacked with meetings and managerial responsibilities, and you're doing, you know, just even if you just pick up a couple of bits of work a month or whatever, just to, you know, remember how Terraform works, or remember, you know, refresh your Python skills a little bit, or just, you know, pick up something that's not super time critical, that, you know, if you get pulled off into a bunch of meetings, or suddenly you come in that day and realize your calendar is just done. It doesn't matter if that thing happens next week or in a couple of weeks' time, because, you know, I think if you tactically choose your own tasks a little bit, you can keep yourself in the game without, you know, causing a problem. You know, you don't want to be picking up important tickets that need to get through quickly, and then have, you know, cause trouble for your own guys because everyone's going
just like the little bits that no one really cares about. This is it's not really funny. Everyone says the same thing. It's like just. Like, because obviously tech is like evolved so like quickly, and there's updates on everything, like, you know, all the time. Like, you have to sort of you want to see what's going on as well, right? You want to stay relevant, I guess.
That's one thing I think we do quite well. It's something that I've sort of started recently with the guys, is trying to have like a quarterly. I called the first one like a DevOps day, where we all try and get together in person in a meeting room somewhere. For us, it was up in our central London office, because we had Ben coming down from Manchester, and just like going, right, what cool stuff have you seen? What have you got? You know, what's that tool that you've been wanting to have a look at for a while? Let's have a sort of little hack day on it, and just see, is there a use case for it here? And if there is, then we can, you know, have a bit of a play with it within the confines of the day, and then we have something to show, like, my manager or whatever afterwards, going, don't know if you'd heard of this, but, you know, here's a cool thing that we've done. And actually, I think it could be really, you know, could bring real value or whatever. And I think having the freedom to play with those new toys is just as important as anything else, because like you say, it moves so quickly that you...
It's a really cool process to have. I mean, it usually, like, obviously smaller companies are more sort of, you know, fluent with it, I guess, because they have that freedom. But yeah, 100%, like, it's there's so many tools, like, all the time, like, that just get created and you're like, well, what's this? Like, there's always new ways of sort of simplifying things or making things faster, for sure. I've always found that in a bit, for sure, in the thoughts on AI in a bit.
Oh yeah.
But let's talk a little bit more about away from tech, I guess. So from your side, I guess, you know, being a part of you know, F1, you know, very obviously high intense, sort of busy sort of environment, what keeps you sort of busy outside of tech, I guess, and what are you, I guess, passionate about?
I mean, my family keep me extraordinarily busy. I have a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old, so they're both quite full on. My daughter's recently gotten into K-pop Demon Hunters, and all I've heard is her walking around the house belting out K-pop Demon Hunters. So they keep me super busy, and yeah, they're fantastic. But outside of sort of family life, you know, cooking, I've recently gotten back into Warhammer, which I loved as a kid, but I just haven't had the time or the space. But we've recently been able to put a little summer house at the end of the garden, so there's now a protected quiet space where we could just sort of go and relax. For a while I was super into my cycling, but that's fallen by the wayside a little bit with the family. So, but I think it is, you know, and obviously, you know, video games and just tinkering. I've got a home lab, because every good nerd should have a home lab. And, you know, it's hard to find that balance, but I think having things to do, not on the computer, not, you know, walking the dog, all that kind of stuff, just getting out and away from the screens for a bit and not being all tech all the time, as much tech you need.
I think that's obviously what I was going to follow up on after, because obviously working on tech, and it's all a bit much sometimes, like we said, right? From your side, I mean, how do you personally sort of manage with I guess the balance and well-being of, like, you know, not burning out, like we sort of had a little sort of chat a little bit earlier on that side.
So for me, work-life balance is super important and is kind of a challenge. I think everyone faces it's one that certainly Formula One faces sometimes. Those race weekends are long. You know, we have to be in a couple of hours before the first session and stay until probably an hour after the race is finished, just to make sure everything goes smoothly. Luckily, the DevOps team don't currently have to do that, but we, you know, we help out and we tag along to a few races a year. But, you know, it's not mandatory for us, because if we've done our job right, everything should already be in place from, you know, before change freeze. So one of the things that my first boss, I came in for my first day at that service desk role, and my manager said something that's sort of stuck with me ever since, which was, it sort of centers around expectations management and stuff, but he said, you know, you're paid to be here from 9:30 till 6:00. You get an hour for lunch, get here for 9:30, leave at 6:00 and take your hour for lunch. Sometimes you'll have to stay late. Sometimes you'll have to work a weekend. Like, don't grumble. But if you set the expectation, the culture at that place was very much, especially because it was a marketing firm, was very much any hour of the day, the client gets in touch, the client gets a response. And he said, don't, like, set that expectation early that, you know, end of working day, you'll respond tomorrow. And, excuse me, it will surprise people for the first couple of weeks, and then that's fine. And then you'll, that is what they will expect from you. That is where that line in the sand will be drawn. And it's really easy, especially when you're doing, you know, cool new projects, doing exciting stuff, playing with something that you're really excited to get stuck into. It's really easy to get drawn into working till 7 or, you know, popping in, doing a couple of hours on a Saturday morning just because you've got a bit of time. And it's so easy to do. And I never want to discourage it, because if someone's that enthusiastic, it's great. But I try and reinforce that, you know,
you don't need to.
Don't need to. You're not expected to. If you want to do that off your own back, you know, totally fine. But I think it's really important for everyone to have time away from things, because, setting that expectation is key. So nice. One thing I've said to all of the guys when they've started is exactly the same thing that my first boss said to me is, you know, get here when you're supposed to be here, take your lunch break, leave on time. And then occasionally we'll have to do some out of hours work. We'll have to do, you know, update a critical system at 8 o'clock at night, or sometimes we'll have to come in and help with some of the race deployments or whatever. And, you know, when those things come round, then do them with good grace, because, you know, they're not the norm and we're all trying to help out at the end of the day. So,
yeah. Nice. Have you ever experienced burnout from your side, or?
Oh, yeah.
How have you handled it from your end, I guess, is
trying to distance myself from it a little bit. So usually it's a sign I need a holiday if I start to get burnt out. But sometimes, you know, sometimes a holiday doesn't fix it. So sometimes there have been times where I've been burnt out for non-tech reasons. And I think if you get to that stage, it's probably time to find a new job. Being brutally honest, like, you know, sometimes it's not the tech that's causing the mental strain, and in those cases I think you just move on. But when it is tech, then yeah, just try and minimize it outside of work as well, I think, because obviously if you're, you know, you're hacking away at Kubernetes clusters all day, then you're hacking away in your home lab all night, and then you're, you know, playing video games all evening, or, you know, if you just live on the screen, like in front of your desk the whole time, you do just start to go a bit stir crazy. And I think, you know, go out, do something different,
change the scenery.
Yeah, change the scenery. Just try and break the cycle, because it's such an easy sort of spiral to just fall into, where you're just always doing.
Yeah. Well, from yourself, I mean, I know you've been managing not for too long still, but, you know, obviously you've been doing it for like, say, 6 months or so. I know you said you sort of introduced very similar things when you started, you know, in tech, in the sense of, you know, here's the time, here's your lunch, and, you know, basically just take care of yourself, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
From what you're saying, have you sort of experienced anything from the time you've been managing so far where you've needed either to support the team, or is there any sort of initiatives in F1 where they support that sort of, you know, like if someone is struggling a little bit, like what do they do, or where do they go, sort of?
I've not had to deal with it, if I'm honest, because I think my guys are pretty good at looking after themselves. It's something that they've actually said to me is, you know, thank you for setting that expectation, because where they've worked before, no one's actually said to them, like, here's what we're expecting from you.
Well, you've set the scene, right? You sort of said, like,
yeah. But if, yeah. I think the sort of person that ends up, well, often the sort of person that ends up in a role like a DevOps role is someone who likes to help, is eager to sort of, you know, get stuck in, solve the problem, that kind of thing. And so when you've got that kind of personality trait, it's very easy to just get sucked in and do it all the time. So there have been a few times where I've had to step in, and I've seen, you know, I'll be cooking dinner for the kids, and I'll see a message pop up on my phone at sort of 7:30, and then I'll see one of the guys respond, and I'll be like, and then I'll sort of check in and see what's going on, and be like, no, they'll deal with this tomorrow. You know, this is not a critical outage. This is not something that needs to be fixed right now. This is something we'll deal with tomorrow.
Yeah, nice. I mean, look, let's dive a little bit more into sort of the tech side and the DevOps front, I guess. So, I mean, from your side, I mean, obviously you've been in DevOps for a long time, and, you know, even at F1, it was, you know, the whole time you was doing DevOps, right? So I guess, from your perspective, how do you sort of apply DevOps to the unique environment of F1, I guess? Like, how does it benefit the F1, I guess, supply the
Yeah, that is the million-dollar question. So when I started, there had been a DevOps engineer before working in the software team, but it hadn't sort of worked out because I think the business side, it was more of an IT function. So they then recruited in for DevOps engineer in the IT space. And to start with, everything was super, super siloed. It was very much software would put in a ticket, they'd send the thing, it would go across, cloud team would deploy it. And it was very, there was no bridge. So sort of starting out, that was kind of my first thought and first goal was to try and build that bridge. And now I think we have a really good relationship going with the software development guys. We have regular catch-ups. We ask them for feedback. We ask them for what they want out of the platform that we're building for them so that we can, further accelerate their needs. And I think, we've been trying to track all our metrics like good engineers should, and all the sort of DORA metrics and stuff. And based on those metrics, we are, firmly in the elite category in terms of, cadence of delivery and speed of throughput and stuff. But I think where we've really helped out, certainly from the software side, has been, we've been trying to enable self-service for them as much as possible. With guardrails and stuff, but so for certain things that used to take them, 4 days and a bunch of back and forth on a ticket and two different tickets with two different teams to actually get the thing deployed out, they can now sort of self-serve that. And same with their app deployments and their config deployments and stuff, we're helping automate all that, so reducing errors. Something that I think a lot of people don't realize is, while Formula One is ostensibly a broadcaster, and we do all the TV stuff for the races, we also provide a lot of the infrastructure and a lot of the backbone that supports that. So stuff like the timing system is provided by us. So there's a lot of critical deployments of, config and stuff that happens every event that we've helped to automate. That's just enabled people to, get their configs out quickly, validate them quickly, and make sure that they're going to work. And, they know that once they've deployed out a good config and validated that it works, that it's done. And it takes, it used to take the timing guys 3 days or whatever to go through that process. And now they can do it in like half an hour. So things like that, where it magnifies and multiplies over the course of if you're doing 25 races a year or 24, is it?
I mean, it adds up, doesn't it?
It adds up really quickly. Actually, we're trying to capture those metrics as well when we implement a new automation for people, or when we implement a new system that allows people to do things more quickly or more efficiently or whatever. We're trying to capture those metrics because ultimately, IT is a weird space where you're sort of a sunk cost. So actually being able to say, look, well, actually what we've done here is we've made this so much more efficient that it used to take two engineers 3 days, it now takes one engineer 20 minutes. Those kind of metrics are super important for justifying everything.
So I was going to go on from that as well. So, I mean, obviously, like, tech is so constantly evolving. And do you know what? We spoke to quite a few people and everyone's saying the same thing, I guess, but it's becoming so complex. Like, it's almost like deciding what's needed and what's not, and not overcomplicating like an environment, I guess. Yeah. So the question would be from your side, I mean, what's your sort of perceptions on that? And also, how do you sort of decide the tooling that you would use to not overcomplicate an environment, I guess?
So I 100% agree with those people. But something I've always valued and always tried to focus on as an engineer is simplicity. you know, it's very easy to build a complicated system. It's actually quite hard to build a simple system that does the same thing. So I've had a lot of times where, you know, actually, especially from a sort of senior or now management sort of eye, you know, looking at how things are being put together and trying to make sure that they're simple, robust, scalable. Because if you build things in a way that makes them easy for you to develop on in the future, you know, you're already onto a winner. Whereas I've run into a lot of systems where they've built it in a particular way to fit this current use case, but haven't thought about, well, what if actually we want to then add on, you know, this other system, or if it actually it would be really useful if it interfaced with that. So I think, there's no particular tooling that we use to do that. We have sort of internal reviews. We do well-architected reviews on all of our systems that we deploy, where we all just basically say, here's what I've done. What do you reckon? And, you know, we try and keep it low, like no blame, no judgment, no nothing. But we have a set of criteria that we use internally for, you know, how scalable is the platform? How reliable is the platform? How simple is the platform? And then the person will just sort of present what they've done. And then we'll sort of ask questions. We'll be like, have you thought about maybe if you did it in this way, that would actually reduce this, you know, the cognitive complexity of this system, or it would bring this more into line with other systems that we've built. So I think I think you still need a, you know, a bit of a human touch with that.
I feel like you have to constantly analyze it, right? Like you say, it's because if you don't and you keep adding to like tools and whatnot to the stack, it just becomes too much and it becomes too difficult to not just manage, but I guess the whole environment just becomes, unmanageable in that sense. Like, it's scalable, it's not simple.
Yeah.
It gets out of hand.
Surprisingly quickly as well. I think as well, if you don't have that regular sort of introspection, and if you don't try and keep one eye on the sort of the wider environment and how the things fit together, it's incredibly easy to end up with a sort of organic sprawl where just everything is kind of a mess. We've all been there in, you know, you sort of open, lift the rug and go, oh God, why did I do that? But then
put the rug down.
But then, you know, sometimes I've run into this when I first started as well. Sometimes actually, you know, the systems were put in place with the best of intentions, but actually they've sort of organically grown and they've just sort of gotten way out of control. And sometimes it's actually easier to go, let's just start again. Let's give ourselves a clean slate and let's do it properly from the beginning. And if we build it all in at the start, we'll be fine. And I think in that time at the start of a project as well is really important, because it's very easy to start building without an idea of what you're trying to build. And that's where the real danger lies. I think if you start building with no plan, you just get sprawl.
That's it. It becomes chaos, doesn't it? Goes crazy.
Chaos engineering.
There you go. Look, let's sort of move on a little bit towards, I guess, AI, because AI is sort of everywhere. So, I mean, what's your sort of opinion on AI, I guess, and I guess you use it, and how does it sort of help if you do on your sort of day to day?
AI is such a tricky question. I think, well, my team is at least partially responsible for AI at Formula One, so we're heavily involved with it. You know, we're putting together guidance frameworks and things like that, and model evaluation platforms and stuff, so we can actually have some kind of metrics to base our, you know, opinions of these things on. And I think AI is an incredible tool when used correctly. I think it's a very dangerous tool when used badly. I think it's also very easy to become overly dependent on. It's one of my concerns. It's why I don't personally use it a huge amount, because I think it's very easy to start relying on it too much, and then you lose your own muscle memory. And I've, you know, I've seen it happen, and I've seen the weirdest example. I saw, I was watching a YouTube video about an AI, how to identify like AI writing. And one of the examples in that video, someone had written a YouTube comment, then worried it wasn't good enough, then run it through ChatGPT to then improve the YouTube comment to then post an AI. And I'm just like, a YouTube comment is the most like throwaway
basic thing, isn't it?
Thing. Like it just, it couldn't matter less. And I think it's a real danger of it eroding your sort of confidence in your own abilities. So
I think it's an easy way out, isn't it? It's like,
yeah.
I feel like for me, I'm exactly the same, Jack. But for me, I don't use it as much as I should. Like if anything, I hardly use it at all. For me, you know, I'll be honest, I play a lot of sport and I get a lot of injuries. The way that I use it, and I always say this, it's really weird, but before going to the doctor, I take a picture of like where, for instance, the pain is. And it's unbelievably accurate
really?
Of detecting what's wrong. Honestly, I did my ankle. I did my ankle a couple months ago and I did two ligaments. I tore one and I stretched the other and it got the exact two ligaments before I went to see the doctor. Like it's unbelievably accurate. And do you know what? Anything like that, well, if it hurts or anything, I use it for that instead of like using it for work. that's my use case, basically.
Yeah, there are so many use cases where it is incredibly useful. So we, as part of our partnership with AWS, we built what's it called? Root cause analysis tool that uses like AI agents to interrogate logs and stuff. So you could sort of say, are there any issues with X application? And it will go off, query CloudWatch, look in various locations, come back and say, oh, yes, I can see that, you know, would you like me to generate a Jira ticket for you? And for things like that, where actually, you know, if you're not the expert in the field, but you've noticed something's wrong, something like that is an incredibly powerful tool. Or same with, you know, like coding assistants and stuff. I think used correctly, again, incredibly powerful tool. They're incredible at boilerplate. They're good at summarizing. They're good at, but I think making sure you're using the tools in the right way is really key, because they're also incredibly capable of generating absolute nonsense. So
I was going to say, have you tried it before with this sort of the coding scripting sort of AI side of things?
A lot of people
say it's not like very accurate. Like it's accurate. Yeah. It helps with the core basis, right?
If when you know what you're doing. Becoming popular, I tried it out. I was trying to build a Yarn build or something for a dashboard of some sort, and I hadn't really used Yarn, so I was like, well, out of interest, let's see, you know, everyone's excited about these things. And I said, generate me a Yarn build for you know, RCI platform, and it spat out what looked very convincing. The commands all sounded fairly legit. Whacked it in, error. I was like, ah, that's weird, I wonder why. And because I didn't really know the platform, and I think that's where the danger comes in, is, you know, it'll just go, oh, here you go, and be very confident in its response. But actually, I probably spent more time troubleshooting what was wrong with that response than I would have if I just gone and read the docs myself. I don't use it loads. We have built an internal coding assistant that we're starting to use. It's in early beta at the moment. Nice. Which we're hopefully going to start getting some good data in from. But, you know, we're using it across the business. We're using it within the team. But
I feel like it's like you say, it has to be still human managed, I guess, right?
Think you need a certain level of expertise to even just evaluate what it's doing, because, you know, it's very easy for it to spit out something that looks convincing, and then when you try and run it, it just completely fails.
I feel like what's your sort of idea, I guess, from a... Because like you said, I guess it's very much like, if you're too dependent on it, it's a very bad thing, I guess, as well. But from someone that's trying to get into the industry or still quite a junior, what would you say, like, or have you seen, I don't know if you've interviewed or whatnot, but if you've seen engineers like using AI to sort of almost, I don't know, like push their abilities higher than what they actually are? Because they're trying to almost use too much AI.
It's a real tricky one. I think it's I've seen it used incredibly well. I think
I feel like for I don't want to say younger, but almost for like the
I'm terrified.
If the juniors and the sort of you know the less experienced, I guess. If you don't troubleshoot it, it's going to be wrong.
The more powerful the tool is, because you have the ability to evaluate the output. I think for a junior, while it's really tempting, really attractive, because it lets you run arguably before you can walk, you might trip yourself up in the long run, because actually you also might not. Like, you know, it really varies, but I think there is a danger that you could, you know, you fall into just using AI as a crutch rather than using it as a tool to accelerate your development. And I think it's a fine line for sure.
That's it. I mean, I was going to ask you, but you've already sort of mentioned part of it already, but like what would your concerns be about AI and it is very much so, you know, like you said, being too dependent on it, I guess.
Yeah, it's a really easy trap to fall into as well, because you know, I could write all this Python, or I could just have it just, you know, have a code bot or whatever, you know, vomit it out into my VS Code and I'll be done in 5 minutes. But I think, you know, it's like with all things, I think. And coding is no different. Like, if you don't, it's the same reason I think it's important to keep in with the tech stuff when you're doing management, is if you don't flex the muscle, it will waste. Like, you will slowly lose that skill. And if you rely too heavily on AI, I think you can start to just lose your own skill level. So I think yeah, like I've said before, when it's used well, it can really accelerate development. When it's used badly, it can quite quickly become a bit of a crutch that is probably detrimental in the long term. So,
has it started raining at yours by any chance?
No, my dog started scratching herself.
What dog have you got?
She is a, what is she? She's a Central Asian village dog, according to her DNA test.
Oh, wow. Wow.
She's a complete mutt, basically. She's the worst of the mutts.
I've got a golden retriever. He's
lovely.
He's literally right here. Just
I did a DNA test on her because I couldn't work out what she was. She's got a little bit of sort of greyhound snout, a little bit of greyhound tail. No, it's not greyhound. A German Shepherd tail. A little bit of, you know, she's quite white. A bit of everything. I was like, what on earth? Like, what are you made of? So, one of my colleagues, other halves, runs a dog walking business. So they've done a bunch of like DNA tests on their dogs out of interest. And he gave
me. You never know. You might have like a werewolf or something. Just...
Yeah. So I did a little DNA test on her and it just came back. And to be fair, I was so convinced it was not a scam, but you know, it was going to be led astray that I didn't even upload a photo of her. And the little drawing that came back of a Central Asian village dog on the report was pretty much exactly what she looks like. So I was,
There you go.
Is this legit? Fair enough.
I wonder how they use it. Maybe it might be like, there has to be some sort of AI based in that as well.
I don't know. Yeah. I think they analyzed the deer. I had to do a cheek swab of her and stuff. But they, she's come back with a bunch of like relatives through the platform. And all of them are like 15% and they're all German Shepherds. So there's clearly some like common lineage in there with a German Shepherd. But yeah, she's a
nice. Let's dive into more about like the work that you do at F1, I guess. Obviously a lot of people would be interested in this because, you know, it's one of the most, I think it's one of the best sports out there. I watch every single race. For me, I'm a huge fan. So I mean, for those that would be listening, I mean, can you give like a sneak peek behind the curtains, I guess, of a day to day for a DevOps engineer behind what does that look like at F1?
It's really varied, if I'm honest, and that's I suppose part of the joy of it. But so one of the most unusual things about F1 as a business, I think, is the cadence of the change trees. So because we obviously, you know, we're putting on an average of a race every other week, from the Wednesday of the race event till the Sunday after the race, we're in change freeze. Nothing is allowed to be changed unless something is broken. There's a bug fix, an emergency change, whatever. So we have this really unusual cadence, especially in like a double header or a back to back, of these like incredibly tiny sprints where we have to just get all the stuff done and then get it out the door. And then there'll just be whole stretches of time where we can't touch production at all, which is quite bizarre. But it does mean that, you know, when it's busy, it's really, really busy. And the other surprising one, I think, is the summer break is and the winter break are our busiest times because...
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's when
I guess that's the development stages, right?
Yeah, that's when we're allowed to break stuff. So that's when all the, like, all the big changes go in, when all the big pieces of work have to happen. But yeah, supporting the event is incredible. So we have a huge remote facility in Biggin Hill, where I'm based, which is where all the sort of technology center, it's our technology center. It's where all the stuff for the event happens on the day. So we used to, my boss likes to tell the story of, pre-COVID, we used to ship effectively two data centers around the world to every race. And when COVID hit and suddenly we had, you know, 300 engineers sat there going, well, what do we do for 3 months? They had a long-term plan that they were going to bring one of them into a remote site. And it was supposed to be like a 2-year piece of work or something. But during COVID, when, you know, they couldn't, there was no change freeze, there was no anything, they crunched that down into about 3 months. And so since COVID, we only send one data center around now. And if you see the place on a race day, it's incredible. There's, you know, hundreds of people sat at, you know, all these different screens monitoring the telemetry that's coming in, or the camera feeds, or the, you know, you've got the production booths along one side with the like commentators in them doing commentary, you know. It's honestly incredible, and the logistics behind everything that goes on.
It's crazy how it works, isn't it?
It's wild
when you think about it. But that's really cool. I mean, you guys have got like a very sort of well known partnership with AWS. I know you mentioned that before, and I guess a lot of the analysis during the races that they show, like, you know, they've got like the AWS figures and whatnot.
Yeah.
Do you get much involved within sort of the partnership and
yeah, so we have a joint sort of joint technical fund, for want of a better phrase, where, you know, there's a siloed pot of money for coming up with cool innovations to work on with AWS. So we have a sort of, so every couple of years, well, several times a year, we'll kick off a big project to do something exciting or something new, something different that we haven't done before. The most recent one was that RCA tool I was telling you about, which has actually proven itself incredibly useful for a few different things. But yeah, so, you know, the day to day is super varied. Like I say, like we work with the timing teams, we work with the software team, we work with the quality department. You know, we work with teams across the business doing everything from, you know, AI tooling to pipelines to building Python frameworks to build, you know, we get involved in so many different parts of the business that and so many different sort of disciplines that it's really fun because it's so varied.
I guess it's quite rewarding as well, right? Because very successful, isn't it?
Yeah, and when you see that little, you know, powered by AWS graphic pop up on screen or something, you're like, I didn't build it, but that wouldn't be there without us, you know.
Yeah, there you go.
See, it also gives you a whole different appreciation for, like, when you see things happening on screen, you could be like, ah, oh, interesting. You know, if one of the graphics goes a bit wonky or something, you're like, oh, you know, that system.
Yeah. You're working without even knowing, right?
Yeah. Like, ah, oh, I don't need that. I just want to enjoy the race. But no, it is amazing. It's a really cool place. It's a weird hybrid of sort of sprint, like moving fast, sort of almost startup like in terms of like got to get stuff done, got to get stuff, you know, and then sort of big enterprise like change management and sort of. So it's an interesting puzzle. It's completely unlike anywhere I've ever worked. But
best of both worlds. That's the best way you can describe it, right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of culture still to win over, but we're making good headway as well. So
nice. I was going to say to you, so from your perspective, I mean, what does success look like for you and your team, I guess, from a from that technical and cultural perspective, I guess. So yeah, what does that look like for you?
So for us, like I say, because largely our involvement is done before change freeze, you know. If everyone's managed to build their software, get the software deployed, you know, get the configs out and everything ahead of change freeze, we're all right for the race itself. But those things still get evaluated. So all issues that happen during the event get tracked in a big Jira board, and they have to be investigated and explained, and you have to sort of put your root cause in. So for us, for example, if we've done a transformation piece to automate deployments of configs for a particular application or whatever, if they then, you know, don't, if their number of errors trends down ideally to zero, then that's a huge success for us, because, you know, we've made a meaningful impact to the sort of reliability of service and the, you know, the broadcast. And same with, you know, if we can enable the software guys to get their stuff deployed more quickly, more smoothly, you know, with more testing and all that kind of stuff, then ultimately we've almost got a bit of the SRE side of things going on as well, where ultimately the single most important thing for the company is obviously the broadcast. So anything we can do to improve reliability, improve confidence in systems, improve troubleshooting, and, you know, anything like that, those are our, you know, big KPIs, our big metrics that we try and track and make sure are heading in the right direction. So
yeah, I think it's definitely, I mean, I've watched it for years and years. I used to go to like Silverstone with my dad like year when I was younger, and even if you think like how it's evolved over the years, it's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, over the last 20 years, like, yeah. Honestly, it's crazy. So it's even crazier to think what like it would look like in the next, you know,
yeah,
even 10 years, in the next few years.
Some of the systems coming down are certainly technologically super interesting. Obviously, probably not ones I can talk about, but like there are some, just, you know, the technology and the level of engineering behind it all are pretty insane.
Yeah. Look, if you this one's a little bit sort of out there, I guess, in that sense. But if you had to start again with your journey at, say, F1, would you change or refine anything in the DevOps space from your side?
Since I started?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there anything you think that could have, or you would have sort of changed, I guess, from your side?
I might have picked a different tool here or there, but I think fundamentally, I think we've done a really good job. When I first started, there was no real sort of DevOps culture, and we've sort of slowly over time, you know, we've gone, oh, look, we've built this cool platform, some cool things it does. And, you know, the devs have gone, oh, that's nice. Could we do that? And, you know, slowly sort of, I think it's really important when you're trying to win people over, if you just, you know, you start with little steps, little sort of encouragements, little carrots to dangle or whatever. You don't hit them with the stick, you dangle the carrot. And then, you know, once they start to get by and once they start to see some of the benefits, then these things sort of start to snowball. And we're finding that more and more, you know, we're just getting busier and busier as more and more of these teams sort of start to realize that, you know, there's things we can automate, there's things we can build for them, there's Python libraries we could give them access to, there's, you know, all this kind of stuff where actually we're making a huge difference across the business. So no. I don't think there's anything specific I would change. Like I say, I might have chosen, you know,
you've done well. You've evolved the system, so it's,
yeah,
DevOps culture is getting better.
Yeah, it's been a slow progression, because everything is in a large enterprise. But I think we're really starting to build a lot of momentum now, and I think we're doing amazing stuff, like week in, week out. So I'm really proud of what we've done. I think it's really, you know, really impressive, especially when you look back, because you sort of, when you're in the thick of it, you don't really think about all these little incremental improvements, and then you look back and go, crikey, you know, 3 years ago, it, you know, everything was completely different, and you know, we've made a huge impact.
It's always like that, isn't it? It's just that reflection part is sometimes it's needed to see how far you've come.
Yeah, I think it is
really cool.
Yeah.
Look, from your part, I mean, for anyone that is, I guess, trying to get into the tech space, so trying to get into DevOps and that side of things, what sort of advice would you give them for those that are beginning their journey?
Tinker. Just tinker with things. I think every good engineer has a home lab for good reason. I think my home lab was partially responsible for me getting this job. You know, the tools that you like, the tools you read about, the tools you're interested in, if you're not using them in your day job, have a play with them, like, on your own. I know that's slightly counter to what I was saying about burnout, but I think that balance is the key. And if, you know, if you're interested in a tool, just play with it. You know, I hadn't used Kubernetes at all before I started at F1, really, except on my home lab, because I was interested in Kubernetes. I wanted to understand it. So I spun up a K3S cluster on my home lab. And then during the interview, my boss said, you know, oh, what are your Kubernetes skills like? And I sort of said, well, you know, being honest, I've not used it in production, but I have it on my home lab, and I've used it to deploy a bunch of tools for, you know, for myself. And so I've got a good understanding of it. I just haven't. I think, you know, even just showing that level of interest and level of curiosity, I think goes a long way, as well as giving yourself that experience. So I think that would be my number one tip is just find something to experiment on, you know, an old laptop or whatever.
That's the beauty of it, isn't it? It's like you break it, fix it, just experiment with it.
I was playing with something the other night, and I completely broke my own cluster, and then I was like, oh, I'm going to finally get some tinkering time, and I sort of started hacking away, and then what have I done? And realized I blocked the Kubernetes API by mistake, and I completely bricked the cluster. And I had to sort of then go in and fix it. I was like, why have I, you know, but just breaking stuff and playing with it and understanding what you've done and then working out how to fix it is such a valuable exercise that, you know, even if you're not getting to do it in your day job, I think, you know, play with the tools that everyone's using, because there are ways to play with them all that are incredibly accessible. So
nice. Awesome. And the way we finish off, Jack, like I mentioned to you already, but it's we've got a question for yourself from our last guest, which is Matteo. And after that, we'll get you to ask a question for the next guest. So the question from Matteo was, what do you love and hate the most about your job?
Gosh, what do I love and hate the most? I would say, I don't want to give a cop out answer, but I love the variety of projects we get to work on. I think as a team, the wider cloud team and stuff, we're really good at, you know, looking at new tools, finding the use cases, finding the value. So I think, yeah, I love that side of things. Things I hate, probably a boring answer, but the amount of training we have to do in terms of fire alarms and safety training and InfoSec training and all that kind of stuff. I understand the value of it, but I think I get about one a week, and it's just a little bit too much. So,
yeah, good stuff. And what's your question to the next guest?
Oh, gosh. What? That's a very good question.
Could be absolutely anything.
What is a... I'm trying to think of how to word it. What is a common sort of pitfall you've seen people people fall into, and how would you avoid it? I think something along those lines. So, you know, what's a common trap that you've seen catch people out, and how should they avoid it?
How to overcome it. Overcome up with it. Okay. Good stuff. Awesome. Look, Jack, it was lovely to speak to you.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed our chat, and thank you for your time.
No worries. Thank you.